Okay, let us slowly get started. Project one is due and homework one is also due. Homework two, okay, whichever it is, whichever is due, it's due. I guess it's homework two, okay. Yes, changes. Yes. Well, as long as they're together, I guess. If not, you have to make sure that they're together. Okay. Okay. So first things first, if it's particularly hot today, it's not because of two things being due on the same day. It's because Earth is really warming up. It's as warm as it has been in million years. So it's not my problem. Just keep that in mind. The other thing is, since you've been spending, I guess, all your waking minutes and hours doing the project, are there things that you want to get off your chest about either interesting observations that you made while running the project or anything else that you might want to talk about? Yes, sir.
On the project one, the extra credit part two, I think, where you were splitting up and distributing a value across the G and the H value, I couldn't see what that was actually doing. I couldn't get my test cases to run. I think I know what it was supposed to do.
So remind me the part. I mean,
it
so
was, if you have a W,
okay, so weighting.
Right.
So that's actually an interesting question. I think it's also kind of asked in the homework too. So since you submitted both, I guess I can talk about this. So the idea is, the A star search is admissible as long as H is admissible and you combine G and H with equal weights. Okay, that's the only time it's admissible. However, many a time you would like to actually weight the heuristic higher because the heuristic is telling you how close you are to the goal, and so you may want to say 5 times H, G plus 5 times H. Normally many practical systems wind up weighting the H 5 times compared to G, and they do better in practice. Okay, but you are not guaranteed to be admissible. I mean, you're not guaranteed to be optimal. So that's the usual. Good. That's exactly. And in fact, people have spent, at the time when A star search was like a big research area and in itself, the people have written papers talking about how much do you lose exactly when you don't have equal weight for G and H. Okay, so if you are interested, send me an email. I can point you to places where that's been discussed. Okay. Other comments?
I think some problems with the
virtual
search. Uh-huh. For nodes more than 8, the program needs to get terminated.
That's probably your program. If you cannot do more than 8, then you're in trouble. So you're in the
system. It runs for about 5 minutes.
8, just 8 is the number of states?
No,
that's this. Either you are using a list which has serious resource limitations. Otherwise it doesn't make sense. That's all I can say. Just doing 8 states and running out and dying makes no sense. Okay. Other point? Yes, sir. Oh, you're talking about steps or states?
Steps,
of course, can make a big difference depending on, 8 steps with breadth first search is humongous because what's the branching factor in the puzzle problem? 4. Okay, so you're talking about B power D. So 4 power, that's still not too bad, really.
It runs for about 5 minutes.
think for 300 seconds.
4 power 8, unless you have a memory restriction, it's still 8 is too small, given the branching factor of 4. Okay? Because the branching factor is small enough. Normally, going 8 depth can be pretty bad in some domains where there's a huge branching factor. And breadth first has to consider the entire branching factor. Yes?
No, because I noticed that for one of the, so the third test case was, I think it was 5 steps away or something. Mm-hmm. And just for that, breadth first produced around 577 nodes or so, generated. So, I mean, that's quite an amount, especially as they're representing each one as an array and all added.
No, I mean, no, I think normally you should give up even breadth first search. I mean, basically it ran out of memory, presumably. Is that the idea? Okay. I mean, then basically there may well have been resource restriction.
Right.
I think, in fact, and did you increase the resource restriction? Because there is a way of increasing the heap size for the machine. And in fact, EA talked about it. He sent a mail.
Right.
If you increase it, you know, it's still, it's kind of too, I mean, normally breadth first search should be allowed to run until it runs out of memory, and depth first search should be allowed to run overnight, you know, just so that, that's the whole point of learning that heuristics help, you know, I mean, once you do that, then you know that it really does help. Other points? Any other comments on, yes?
I noticed that for, okay, so we were given 5 test cases.
Mm-hmm.
For those 5, the Manhattan distance and display style seem to be almost on par, the performance. It's taking a lot of factors into account, like nodes generated, time taken, space taken, and all that stuff. But as soon as we got to 11 and 12, and because these were random states that we were making using the random permute function, as soon as we got to 11 and 12, there was a remarkable increase in performance using Manhattan distance.
Yeah. So normally, it's normally the way the search curves look oftentimes is that you can't tell the difference at the smaller problems. You know, even when heuristic 1 is better than heuristic 2, you would wind up looking at things like this. So this may be the curve for heuristic 1, and this may be the curve for heuristic 2. And you'll start seeing the major difference that you would feel in the sense, oh my God, I had saved a day. I mean, you start seeing it here, not here, because there they're both, one is 0.3 milliseconds, one may be 0.2 milliseconds, and at that level, in fact, all other external factors wind up coming into play. You know, in fact, none of the Lisp implementations are extremely good, are perfect in taking away the garbage collection time. So if they kind of, you know, wind up, if the garbage collection time affects the speed, I mean, for the timing a little bit, it's going to make a bigger difference here than here. Okay, so that's not surprising. I mean, I think the way I set up the project, if you just did, you know, the cases that I gave, you know, you don't have to really stay awake overnight. But then it's just the beginning, and you can do a huge number of other, I mean, I gave various things that you could play with, okay? And furthermore, the next project, which will be given out on Thursday, is essentially going to use the code that you developed for the first project, okay? So you would do regression planning using the same A-star search code, okay? So I've been telling you in the class that it's just child generator function is going to change. So you will write your own child generator function and the termination criterion. So, if your code wasn't working for the first project, you still have one more chance to make it work, because for the second project you need that. Okay. Yes, sir.
In terms of the time it takes to resort the queue, I didn't have time to do an analysis on that.
So I think, you know, there have been times when I'm not exactly sure who has done what sorts of neat analysis. All of these things are here, and in general, every time when I teach it, there'll be some people who have, you know, probably done it, completed everything early enough that they did a lot more analysis. And I know at least one time somebody actually did an analysis on doing the merge sort versus resorting and showing that it made a big difference for him, you know. But again, it's again at the level of larger problems. That's when, you know, the queue starts becoming large, then you're going to pay for it. Other questions, comments? Okay? Anything else unrelated to the project? That you wanted to ask any questions unrelated to the project? I mean, something about the stuff that we've been discussing last time. Okay. So, I'm going to continue my discussion on Markov decision processes. I'll quickly repeat, review the couple of slides that we went through last time, and then spend time today talking about two classic approaches for solving Markov decision processes. One is called value and another is called the policy iteration. And then after that, we will start talking about real-time approaches or online approaches for solving Markov decision processes. An online approach is one where you don't have a lot of time to come up with the solution before you start executing. Somebody told you it's like you're trying to cross rural road, and what's the best direction to go? If you take like an hour to figure out the optimal direction to jump in, by that time you're dead, you know, because you know, the world is changing too fast. So in an online approach, you actually care about the amount of time you spend doing search versus doing the execution. And so we will go from MDPs into a version of solving MDPs called real-time dynamic programming. That winds up being very interesting for several reasons, one of which is we get to talk about what would A-star search look like if you were to do online A-star search. You know, the way A-star search is currently being done, you do everything up front. You complete the optimal path, and then you start executing it. And you've been seeing that, you know, depending on your heuristic, it could take forever to even find the path. Okay, so if you need to get by, and if there's a time tick and say, do something right now, then what would you do? You know, if I only give you 10 minutes to make your first move, what would you do? Okay, and then go from there to talk about another very compelling online scenario, which are games. In the games, you know, let's say a board game like chess, you don't get to take infinite amount of time to figure out what your move is. Even the most boring grandmaster level games, they still have only 3 hours. And the lightning one, of course, it's lightning. So you have to make moves very fast. So the question is, without having figured out the optimal path up front, you know, you would have to make moves. And it turns out that in games, you actually have multiple agents, at least two agents in a chess game, right? It turns out that there's a nice way you can go from MDPs into games. That's why I thought of put MDPs here. And you can think of games as almost like a small tweak to single agent MDPs. And then we'll start talking about game search then. Okay, so that's just an overview of what we're going to do. So we talked about MDPs, we talked about an example. This is an example case where I have some rewards here, and then I have, for the intermediate state, I had a little negative reward. For this and this, I have positive rewards. I mean, one is positive, one is negative. And then I also said these two are sync states, in the sense if you ever get into those states, you can never come out of them. So there are no actions that are applicable in those states. For every other state, there are actions applicable, and the usual action, the only action in this kind of scenario, in this example, the only action that's applicable is go up, go down, go left, go right. And they all have the following property. When you're trying to go in a particular direction, with 0.8 probability, you go in that direction, and 0.1 probability each, you'll go in the other two directions. You apparently don't go back, you know, but you could go into the other two directions. This is just to kind of capture the uncertainty that can happen in terms of, you know, in terms of a stochastic action where the effects are not completely predictable upfront. Okay. However, as I mentioned last time, here is a scenario where actions are stochastic, but the world is completely observable. So you may not know when you are in start and when you try to go up, you may not know whether you will go here or here with complete probability. But once you do the action, you open your eyes, you'll know exactly what happened. Okay? And there is a generalization of MDPs called partially observable Markov decision processes, which I won't even discuss in this class because it's kind of too much out of the scope. That essentially allows even uncertainty about your state. Okay, so that would be a very general model. And in fact, if you can, you can pretty much do everything for single agent in the context of partially ordered Markov, partially observable Markov division processes. It's a very general model. Okay, now one question is, how is this different from the kind of problem solving agent scenario we looked at, the A star search scenario we looked at? In the case of A star search, you do know, for example, what your initial state is. You do know what your goal state is. The rewards only exist in the goal state, nowhere else. So if you must write A star search as an MDP, so if you want to write like a 8 puzzle problem or anything that you can do with A star search as an MDP problem, you can do it. Okay? You have actions which are deterministic, and you only get rewards in the goal states, and goal states are sync states. That means once you reach the goal, you don't do anything more. So this model I'm looking at is strictly more general than A star search. This is strictly more general than A star search. It's more general in at least two ways. Okay, one of course is I can have rewards pretty much anywhere. It's not just the sync state. You know, I can have reward just for passing through A state. I can collect the reward and move on. Okay, and general MDPs don't even need sync state. No state has to be sync state. You know, in each state you have a reward. And the question of course is, you want to maximize the reward you will get. That's point one. Point two is, this also, this, you know, when you add that with the fact that actions are non-deterministic or stochastic, you in essence really need to know what is my best action for every state I could find myself in. It's not enough to just say, here's the initial state, here's the goal state, this is the set of actions, sequence of actions you have to do. Because, you know, because the actions are not deterministic. So suppose I want to go here. One idea would be I go up, back, I mean, and to the right, and then go there. It looks like that's a reasonable thing to do. Except that's not a plan. Because when I try to do this, suppose I come here, then what happens? The rest of the actions won't make any sense there. So I actually have to look at what happened, what state I am in. And since there is a non-zero probability that I can be in any of these states, I really need a policy. Not just a plan, but a policy. Now, what's the difference between a plan and a policy? A plan, essentially, you can think of it as, it tells you follow this sequence of steps. And in fact, general size plans can also say, do these steps, take some observations, do more of these. When do these actions, take an observation, do more actions. But a policy, a full policy essentially tells you, for every state that you find yourself in, what's the best action that you're supposed to do. That's what a policy is supposed to tell you. Okay. Again, A star search would be a special case of this MDP. So if you have deterministic actions and you have rewards only at the sync states, then you don't really need a full policy, because if you know the initial state, for example, you know that you're going to start from an initial state, and when you start doing actions from that initial state, you know exactly the states that you would go through. And once you have figured out the optimal path, you only need to know what to do on the states that appear, that are expected to appear, you know, when you're doing this plan. In fact, what's more interesting is, if you have a deterministic set of action, deterministic actions, you can close your eyes and start executing the action. Once the A star search tells you what the 8 puzzle solution is, you can close your eyes and do those actions and say, I got there. Okay? Because no, there is no uncertainty. You don't really need to look at the, it's proved, you know, given your domain model, it's proved that if you do those actions, you would be in a goal state. Okay? So for an A star search, finding a policy is an overkill. I mean, for a deterministic problem where all reward is concentrated at the end, it's not really worth finding a full policy. Okay? Whereas for this kind of much more general scenarios, you would like to find a full policy. Okay. Now, much of what we would be doing in MDPs is, it's kind of an interesting issue. What we are actually trying to even find a method, a brute force method for the policy, the optimal policy. In the case of problems that could be solved by A star search, what is the brute force method? Basically, finding shortest path is what we are answering in the case of A star search. And the heuristics would give us, basically would try to let us find the shortest path faster. So in fact, you should think of, right now you should think of this, whatever approaches we do for MDP, as uninformed or blind approaches. Basically, they don't actually use any extra heuristics. Even then, finding the optimal policy turns out to be interesting, because you essentially, because it's not obvious as to what it is that you're optimizing. Okay. In particular, I mentioned, I believe, that last time that, you know, for this particular problem, this happens to be the optimal policy. If the numbers are the way I gave you, you know, if I gave you minus 0.04 as the rewards for each state, and plus 1 here and minus 1 here, and then those are the sync states, then the optimal policy for this problem is this. So if you are in this state, go like this, and if you are here, don't go up, go here. Interesting. Because it's not shortest path, it is making sure that the reward that you get is maximized. And if you go, try to go here, there is a possibility that you'll go here. As, I mean, and when you try to go here, from here actually you can only go this side. But once you come here, when you try to go up, there's a possibility you'll go here. Now notice that when you are here, you're still going up, because you're already sunk. You are stuck in this state. The best you can do is get out of it. And you know, either you have to go up or come, you know, come down or go up. You may as well go up, because there is some chance that you'll get to plus one. If you come down, there is nothing. And in both ways, you have the, about the same chance of falling into hell, which is minus one. Okay? It makes sense. It makes perfect sense, you know, for a small problem like this, that this is sort of a reasonable policy. Now, this optimal policy is connected in the case of MDPs. There is a useful quantity we can talk about called utility or value function. Okay? For each state here, you can talk about these numbers here, tell you the optimal value function or the utility function. Okay? And what they're saying really is, if you find yourself here, and from here you would do the best you can possibly do in the rest of your life, the maximum you can expect to get on the long term is 0.7 units of utility. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you could be here and get zero utility. I mean, you could be born Bill Gates' son, daughter, and still screw up in life. Okay, especially if Bill Gates has given away all his money. Okay, but the issue is, we would still say that the optimal utility somebody might achieve starting from being, let's say, Bill Gates' son, is probably slightly higher than the optimal utility that somebody might achieve starting from some other, somewhat less well-to-do position. Okay, in both cases we are talking about, if you behave optimally starting from then onwards, what's the maximum reward you can get? If you find yourself here, you can get as much as 0.7 maximum reward, maximum utility through your life. Okay. Now, when I'm saying this, there is this issue as to how did I come up with this number? What does this mean? And to understand that, okay, we saw this already, but let's see. To understand that, let's go through this notion of how utility is interpreted in market decision processes. In any problem like MDP, these are called sequential decision problems, where you are sort of making a sequence of decisions. Do this, then do this, then do this. Okay, do this and look at your state, and based on the state, do whatever is the best action that's supposed to be done there. In all these problems, the value is associated with behavior. Again, as I said, MDPs are the scenarios where the journey is as important as the goal. Okay, so if you pass through high reward states, then you collect reward as you pass through those states. Okay, the sync states are a special case where you collect the reward and stop there. You'll never get to go anywhere else. But everywhere else, as you're passing through a good state, you get the positive reward. You're passing through a bad state, you get the negative reward. Okay, so one can ask, if I have a behavior, if I have a sequence of states that I have just exhibited, I am the agent, Okay, I took various actions and you are outside of me and you see me going through state S1, S2, S3, etc. up to S15. Okay, you can tell what is the overall utility of the state or the cumulative reward I got by going through these states. The cumulative reward essentially is if S1 has some reward, S2 has some reward, S3 has some reward, then we make the assumption, we make a reasonable assumption that the utility, the rewards are additive. Okay, so if S1 is 0.04, S2 is 0.04 minus 0.4, S2 is minus 0.04, S3 is minus 0.04, etc. And S15 is plus 1, then you are basically, that particular sequence would be 14 times minus 0.04 plus 1. That would be the utility, cumulative reward of that particular sequence. Okay? Now, what I'm trying to optimize essentially in kind of MDPs is the average reward I would get. Because even if I'm behaving optimally, because actions have uncertainty, sometimes I might still get into wrong state. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So an optimal agent may still get into wrong state. So optimal agent is expected to be better than an inoptimal agent only in the asymptotic sense. So if you have 10,000 copies of an optimal agent and 10,000 copies of an inoptimal agent, you would think that the 10,000 copies of the optimal agent overall will behave better. So another way of thinking about it is if you let this, you know, agent work like 10,000 times, you know, and each time it shows a behavior trait, you say, okay, this time you got cumulative reward of 15 units. I'll restart you again. This time you got the cumulative reward of 14 units. Okay, this time you got 25 units. So I would take the average. And what I'm trying to do is to maximize the expected cumulative reward. The cumulative reward is essentially called, the maximizing the expected cumulative reward that you can get starting from the state you are in. Okay. That's what you're trying to optimize in these kinds of scenarios. So utility of a state, it's also called a value, is really defined to be expected sum of the rewards until termination, assuming this. It's very important. If assuming that you do optimal action from there onwards, you just, you know, by an accident of birth, you got into this bad state, or this state, whatever that state is, good or bad state. And assuming that you do optimal action from then onwards until you terminate, okay, then what is the maximum cumulative reward you can expect? And that is actually what we were showing here. That's what we are showing here. So if you are starting from here, the maximum you can ever do is 0.7. If you are starting from here, the maximum you can ever do is 0.3. Expected. Okay. Now, what would these numbers mean if the actions don't have uncertainty? It'll just be the shortest path. You understand what I'm saying? So assume that, you know, to think of a simpler scenario where suppose, in fact, already this is sort of more general than A star. There is also a dead state and a living state, plus one and minus one. But if you just have a plus one sink state and this guy is also normal state and you computed the optimal value function for such an MDP, the numbers in each of these cells will be telling you the shortest cost path from that state to the goal state. The shortest cost assumes that you do the optimal thing from each state that you pass through. Okay, so it makes a lot of sense. You know, all of these are connected well. Okay. So, now one other thing actually, since we are talking about this A star versus MDP connection here a lot, let's talk about the following question. I already said that if you really do have deterministic search, you don't need to compute the policy everywhere. So possibly you also don't need the value everywhere. But there is a function in A star search that does seem to be defined for every state that you ever go through. And since you just did the A star search project, you know what that function is. What is the function in A star search that must be defined for every state? F value and H value. Even though A star search only wants to go from a given state to a given final state, you would say, why should heuristic care about everything that's not falling on the optimal path? But we know that heuristics should care about every state, because that's how you decide what the optimal path is. Okay? So in fact, one of the interesting connections between the value function in MDPs and the heuristic in A star is, in fact, the optimal value function for a deterministic MDP with a single, with only positive goal sync state would be the H star, which it would be the perfect heuristic. It would be the perfect heuristic. Okay, that's the connection. And so, if I, before I get to the optimal value function, as I'm going through this lecture today, I would say that there is a way of getting to the optimal value function by starting somewhere and iteratively improving the value function until it reaches the optimal. Now it turns out that on the way to the optimal value function, the other estimates you get for the value function, that's a good place where you can find heuristics. Because heuristic needs values for all the states. And the value function is giving you values for all the states. And we'll see that an algorithm called value iteration algorithm basically starts from random values everywhere and gets you to this optimal value function, which for the deterministic case would be H star. So it's sort of value iteration, running it a couple of times is a good way of getting estimates of H star. Yes? How does the policy relate to the values is what we'll talk about. Okay, and then, so in some sense, policies relate to probabilities through values. So there's a duality in the MDP formula where this is the maximum expected utility for each of these states. Okay, if I give you this, you can find this out. This is the optimal policy. And if I give you the optimal policy, you can find this out. And these two are connected by a set of equations called Bellman backup equations, which we'll talk about in a minute. Okay? And the Bellman backup equations essentially connect the policy and the value function. Okay? Yes, sir. So that's a very, very, very good question. I said Markov decision processes. Why Markov? Why Markov? People can give names for anything, you know. I never said Markov A star, you know, I just said A star. This is called a Markov decision process. Markov property in general, across the board, means state is enough. Okay? If I know your state, then I don't need to know how you got to this state. And an MDP, essentially a Markov decision process, is one where the maximum utility that you can get starting from that state doesn't depend upon how you got to that state. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, it turns out that it is an assumption. It's not true for all possible decision problems. In fact, it turns out that I can take many decision problems would have non-Markovian reward structure. That means you would get reward of +2 here if you also went to that guy and showed your face. So, you know, there are state S1 and S2. S1 won't give you any reward. S2 won't give you any reward. If you had already gone to S1 and showed your face, at S2 they'll give you +2 units. There, the reward you get at a state depends on the path you took to get to that state. Then it becomes a non-Markovian reward function. Okay, and in fact, people work on this, you know, but MDPs is like a simple case where the reward that you get at a state doesn't depend upon the path you took. Now, even though I made it sound as if Markovian assumption is like a strong assumption, it turns out that if I give you a non-Markov problem, you can change the state space such that it becomes a Markov problem. So you have now new states where a new state S double dash would correspond to you having gone to S1 and S2 in the base state. That will have direct reward. Okay? It's just that if you convert a non-Markov decision process into a Markov decision process this way, the number of states explodes. Nothing comes free. Yes, in this case, so this is an assumption we are making that, so this is the assumption we are making that given a sequence of states, each of which have rewards, the utility of the entire sequence is summative in the utility of the individual state. Okay? Yes, sir. Which one? I mean, how would you find the policy, you mean? Yeah. I don't understand. So you're saying, so say it again, I'm not catching your exact. If I give you the highest utility, these numbers, then finding this is simple. Okay, asking you a simple question, okay? I'll give you H star for a problem. Would you still have to do A star search? For a problem, apart from the initial and goal state, I'll throw in H star. You know, you can ask me and give you the H star function. How many of you would like to have it? Pretty much everybody. Because the moment I gave you the H star, there is no search left. Okay, from the initial state, you look at the 5 children, take the one which has the highest F value. And then from there, take the 4 children, take the highest F value. And you do this, you just go beeline directly to the goal state. Giving H star is actually solving more than just a simple problem. Okay? So in some sense, if I were to give, and this is not easy to get, just as getting H star is, I mean, if you must ask me something, ask me for the shortest path directly. You know, I would rather solve your problem than give you H star, because that's solving more than just your problem. Solving other people's problems too, compared to, you know, all of them have the same goal state but different initial state. I'm solving their problems too now. Okay. So once I do get the optimal utility function, then I can convert it into the value function. Again, the step there is sort of similar to, if I give you the H star, you know what the policy for H star is. Remember that the policy for the H star function is just going to tell you what to do on the states that fall on the optimal path. Yes. How would you find the highest utility, by the way? It turns out there is no way of finding this without this and vice versa. In some sense, so keep that question in your mind and ask me about 10 minutes later when I would have talked about both value and policy iteration. Yes, sir.
Are you going to go through an example of calculating?
Yes. That's the whole point. That's the whole point. Yes. But you're asking a question. Good question. By the way, MDPs are probably some of the deepest things we'll discuss in this class. You know, it's beautiful stuff. Probably most introductory AI courses don't discuss MDPs. But I think it's worth doing it just to stretch your minds. And also, there's a neat way of going from MDPs into game search, you know, which sort of is nice, I think. Okay. So this was the utility thing, and I'm saying, given the utility of the state, choosing the best action is just MEU. If I were to give you the best utility function, okay, then all I need to do to find out the optimal policy, so suppose I have a state space like this, and I gave you the optimal utility numbers for each of these, okay, and if I'm trying to figure out in this state, should I go up, right, left, or down, for each action, I compute the expected utility. So if I were to try going up, with 0.8 probability, I will get this value, V1. And with 0.1 probability, I'll get this value, V2. And with 0.1 probability, I'll get this value, V0. expected value of going up is 0.8 times V1 plus 0.1 times V2 plus 0.1 times V0. That's for action A1. If I can do four actions from this, I'll compute the expected value for each of the four actions. Whichever has the higher number, that's the action I'm supposed to do there. That's it. So given the optimal utility function, converting it into an optimal policy is a no-brainer. In fact, given any estimate on the value function, you can convert it into a policy by doing exactly this. If you believe this number serves the optimal value, I'll tell you what you should be doing as your policy. Okay? So there is a nice reason why we should be interested in utilities. And let me actually show you, since you guys wanted an example, let me show the example and then go back to more interesting issues, some more abstract issues. Okay, so let's just look at this particular problem and write an equation which directly computes the optimal value function. Because I already told you that if I told you what the optimal value function is, using this approach, you can compute what the optimal policy is. Do you understand what I'm saying? Just as if I told you what the H star is, you know what the shortest path is using the H star. Okay, converting H star into shortest path is simple. Similarly, converting V star, which is the optimal value function, into the optimal policy is still simple. Basically, for each state, you consider the expected value of each of the actions and then pick the one which has highest. And if your value estimates are correct, then this would be the optimal action. Now, what I would do now directly is to try and directly compute the optimal value function. Okay? And it turns out that optimal value functions will have a following property. The value of ith state would be equal to the reward that you can get in the ith state plus the expected reward you can get starting from the ith state with respect to the maximal, the best action. So this is the number that I would do. So remember that u is the optimal value function. So if the value function of ith cell would depend upon value function of other guys around it, its neighbors, where neighbors are determined in terms of what are the actions, when you do actions from this state, what other states do you go into? So if I were to do action A in state I, then suppose I would go to state J with probability MAIJ. Remember, in the simplest case, what you would do, you define an action by giving the probability that when you do this action in state SI, what's the probability that you would go to state SJ? If for the deterministic case, this MAIJ would be 1 only for a J, a single J at most. For the probabilistic case, MIJ sums to 1. Okay? So I would then, for all the neighbors I could get to, I multiply the probability of going there with their utility that I will get. Remember, that's again the optimal utility. I don't know what the optimal utility is, but I'm writing an equation that must hold between different cells of the optimal utility. Of different states, the value, optimal utility values for the different states. Now, so this is the thing. The only tricky issue, of course, is that this action A that I'm talking about is max over all the actions. So for all the actions I can do in state I, pick for each action what is the expected value of doing that action A from state I, and then take the action corresponding that will give the maximum utility, take the expected utility for that action, add it to Ri, that would then be the UI. Okay? This, without this, it's child's play. Without this, this is child's play. Without this max, it's a bunch of simultaneous linear equations. Gauss-Jordan elimination will solve it for you. That max kills you. It makes this equation nonlinear. essentially you have one equation of this type for each state. Okay? And so there are, if there are S number of states, there are S number of nonlinear equations that you're trying to solve. All you know is the optimal value would be the solution for these nonlinear equations. And this is actually called, this actually is called the Bellman equation. Okay? Now, just to show you an example here, U of 1, 1 would be written as minus 0.04, because that's the reward for that state, plus max of the following expression. Expression 1 is, you know, if this is going up. If you go up, then you would do 0.8 times the utility of this guy. So 0.8 times U of 1, 2, plus 0.1 times U of 2, 1, plus 0.1 times U of 1, 1. This is the maximum you would do. This is the best you can get if you do going up. If you do this, if you go left, this is the best. And if expected value. And if you go down, this is the one. If you go right, this is the one. So that's your actual equation. You just have to solve this. Now, I have one simple question before I go forward with this. Suppose I have been given the optimal policy. Suppose I've been given the optimal policy, and I'm computing the optimal value function. Remember, I told you that if I give me optimal value function, computing optimal policy is simple. Suppose I gave you the optimal policy, can you compute the optimal value function? Yes. What happens? It eliminates the max. Because once you have a policy, the policy tells you which action you are supposed to be doing. So in the optimal policy case, I forget, what was the one that was saying that we said we are supposed to be doing? Going up? Okay? So you would have only considered this. There is no max. So I'll get a simple series of linear equations. I mean, you never thought linear equations are simple, but, you know, when you're stuck with maximizing over linear equations, you start, you know, looking back to the good old days of linear equations. Okay? So that idea, converting optimal policy into an optimal value function, is called a policy evaluation step. Policy evaluation. And that is basically doable in polynomial time, because it's just a bunch of linear equations. Okay? But trying to compute the optimal value function without knowing the optimal policy is much harder. So if you're given either policy or the value, optimal value or optimal policy, I can get the other one. What's more interesting actually is I told you earlier that if I give you any value function estimate, you can compute a policy that would be the right thing to do if this were to be the optimal value. And similarly, if I give you any policy, you can tell me what is the optimal value you can get if you keep doing that as the policy. Okay? So the connection between value and policy is very tight. And what's more interesting is the optimal value and optimal policy correspond to each other. I'm saying many things, proving which actually will take a whole bunch of time, you know, to actually mathematically prove that these things will be true. But I think they're intuitive enough that you should probably be able to, it's not counterintuitive that these things will correspond. There was a raised hand somewhere. Yes?
If you only know where you are,
No. You expect, no, in the MDP, you expect the model is known. The full model is known. That means you know the entire state space. You know what actions will do. If you do this action, even though I'm in this state, I would still be able to tell you, if I were to try going forward, standing in Castro Street in San Francisco, what would be the states I will get into? I would know that. That's what it means to know the full model. No, we don't. So that's the interesting question is, so I'll basically, this equation makes sense. The question is, what are the magic numbers that correspond to this equation? And it turns out that the spreadsheet metaphor will work. So all I would do in the next slide is convert this equation here into an update rule. So I will start with any random value function. Doesn't matter. Just put some numbers in each of the states. If you don't have any imagination, assume that the value function corresponds to the reward function. That's a reasonable place to start. And then each guy will look around its neighbors and say, hey, I thought I'm zero, but look, you are darn rich. And I can get to you by doing this action, so I should feel rich too. Okay? So in the beginning, the guys right next to the goal think, yeah, they are minus 0.4. But then in within one iteration, they'll say, hey, I'm sitting next to a gold mine. And I'll do an action, I'll be in the goal. So in fact, I should not be zero value, I should be higher value. So I update my value using this. So it's actually possible. The reason max is important is, suppose I'm in a state where this side is gold mine and this side is falling into water, falling into some deep well, okay? And I still have the choice at this state. I can go this way or go this way. If my reward function tells me that this is plus and this is minus, then after all the actions that I have, I would evaluate each of the actions in terms of the expected utility and find that going this way is the highest expected utility, and that will make my utility much higher because my neighbors are rich, so I am actually rich. I say this is spreadsheet metaphor because spreadsheet basically works this way, right? Spreadsheet, when you put numbers and, you know, formulas, then essentially the formulas look around the neighbors, where the neighbors are the ones that are represented in the formulas, and you change one number in one cell, all the other guys change. Okay? That's all. So you start with any old value function, any random estimate, and repeatedly do this Bellman update. This is called Bellman update. Basically, the previous one, when this is equal, this is an equal sign, it becomes the Bellman equation, and this is the Bellman update. Okay? You repeatedly update everybody's value using the Bellman update by looking at their neighbors. Now the idea, of course, is there's a nice theory which shows that this is guaranteed to terminate and it will converge to the optimal value function. This will converge to the optimal value function. And the moment you get the optimal value function, you guys know how to convert that into optimal policy. Right? If I give you optimal value, you know how to do the optimal policy. Okay, so here actually is what happens on this particular example. Here is what happens if I look at, these are the iterations. So an iteration, I'm counting it as everybody looks at your neighbor and updates your value. That's one iteration. Then everybody again looks at their neighbor, update their value, second iteration. Okay? So as I look at the iterations and this is the value, the actual value, and for each of the states, I am tracking how the values of those states are changing. Estimates, optimal values of those states are changing. Notice that in the very beginning, you know the value for this guy and this guy, because they are the sync state. For the sync state, the immediate reward is your final reward. You can't do anything from the sync state. That's the maximum. You cannot go out of a sync state. Okay? So, for the sync state, the immediate reward, so for 4-3, the reward will always stay as plus 1, and for 4-2, the reward will always, the utility will always stay as minus 1. For everybody else, the utility kind of changes and converges to their optimal values. Okay? Couple of questions. Why are these guys' values coming down first? Many of these are coming down first and then starting to raise up. Why? Because think of what happens when you're doing the iterations here. In the beginning, first iteration, all these guys' neighbors are just as much of a loser as this guy. So you think, okay, I'm surrounded by people who are even more of a loser than me, so I should really be depressed. And then after some number of, but in the same iteration, this guy started feeling good. because he actually realizes that I'm actually not much of a loser. This guy really knows that he's not a loser. Now in the second iteration, these guys will feel the benefit of having rich neighbors. And in the third iteration, these guys will. And by the fourth iteration, this guy will also realize that I'm not stuck in life. I have rich neighbors. So in the beginning, the value estimate comes down, but then it goes up. Okay? And furthermore, guys, the nodes, states that are closer to the goal state, closer to the sink state, their optimal values, the value function converges much faster than the ones which are far away. Makes sense. Okay? Sorry. Now, having said this, it turns out this is a very general method. You know, this method is called value iteration. So you start with a value function, iterate it. You know, update, 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 update until you don't change any further. Now, I made it look as if that each iteration, everybody has to change their value. It turns out that there is theory which shows that it doesn't really matter whether everybody changes their value lockstep or whether each node, you know, whether, you know, only some subset of nodes change value. And furthermore, in fact, in the version that I told you, it looks as if in the second iteration, everybody uses their neighbor's first iteration estimate, because neighbors are also changing. But it might actually be nicer for me to know, for me to tell my neighbors, if my value function changed, then within the same iteration, if my neighbors see that, it will be useful. So in fact, it turns out that you may want to do prioritized sweeping, which is go changing the updates, make the updates of the value function in the order in which they are likely to change most. Okay? And if you do that, turns out that the value iteration stops much faster than if you do it in the simpler way. Okay, that's called prioritized sweeping. And in general, pretty much any random way of updating, any random order of updating the values of the states would work as long as you guarantee that in the limit, every state gets updated infinitely often. If that guarantee exists, then I can guarantee that value function would converge to the optimal value. So it doesn't matter if I ignore this guy for the first 15 iterations. As long as before I stop, I look at this guy enough number of times, his value would also converge to the right value. Okay? This is called the value iteration function, value iteration approach. And since I said the values are actually real valued, these are all real valued numbers, they may never actually become identical. So when do you stop the value iteration, first of all? If between two iterations the value function hasn't changed, there's no point in changing it. It's like sort of like graph plan layer, you know, a level up. So if between two value iterations, if the value function hasn't changed, then it's not going to change anymore. Okay? Now, it turns out that since these are real valued numbers, you actually may want to put like a sort of an epsilon and say if the value function hasn't changed by more than epsilon, then you stop. That's the usual practical thing people do. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think the Google search graphing works in a way. Basically, every website will
depend on other websites. Yes, so these are all, I think the only connection there is Google PageRank is basically eigenvector computation. It computes the primary eigenvectors of a large matrix. And it turns out that primary eigenvector of a large matrix can always be computed by what's called the power iteration method, which is again an fixed point incremental method. So that's the connection you'll see. Theoretically, Google PageRank unfortunately has nothing to do with MDPs, but they both have this notion of iterative methods which converge to the optimal value. Okay. So that's the termination. Then comes somebody was saying, I don't know, I thought somebody was saying it, but they didn't say it. Here's the question. Given optimal value, I can get you optimal policy. Given optimal policy, I can get you optimal value. And previously, value iteration is actually computing the optimal value function. Should I consider computing the optimal policy instead? Should I be iterating in the space, in the value iteration, I'm completely ignoring the policy up until I got the optimal value function, and then I just convert it into the value policy, optimal policy. What if I iterate in the space of policies? What if I iterate in the space of policies? So I take one policy, is it good? No, it's not good. Another policy, is it good? It's not good, and keep doing this. Which is better? Here is an interesting question. So if I have S number of states in the MDP, how many possible value functions are there? How many possible value functions are there? Come on, guys. What is a value function telling you? It tells you, it takes a state, maps it into a real number. How many possible mappings are there from S states to real number? What? I don't understand. In the worst case? I don't know what you're saying. I didn't hear what you're saying. Infinite. There are infinite number of value functions. I hope you understand that. Okay? Even though there are only S states, you know, so one value function would correspond to S1 having value 0.0015. Another one corresponds to S1 having value 0.00159834.97. Or maybe 1498, blah, blah, blah. So which are close enough, but still, you know, maybe more than extra. So in general, essentially, there are infinite number of value functions. How many policies are there? If I tell you there are maximum of A actions per state, A power? S power A. Is that true? Is it S power A or A power S? A power S. Because first state I can do one of A actions, second state I can do another one of A actions, third state I can do one of A actions, so A power S. This is the only class where you feel good about A power S. Okay. In every other class you will feel really depressed if you are stuck with A power S, but in MDPs, the number of policies is only A power S, only A power S, whereas number of values is infinite, number of value functions are infinitely many. So if you are in the business of iterating, it looks as if it's not a losing idea to iterate in the space of policies. Okay? And it turns out that, in fact, it is a winning idea. Okay? And this is what this guy is showing. So if there are to be infinite number of value functions, and there are only going to be finite number of policies, and I also said that there is a one-to-one correspondence between values and policies, there definitely is a one-to-one correspondence between optimal value and optimal policy. What does this tell you? It tells you that a whole set of value functions might correspond to the same policy. It has to be that way. Each policy might correspond to infinitely large number of value functions, which is not surprising. So imagine the following thing, okay? In a deterministic case, imagine the following thing. Don't imagine that, that's me disappearing. Imagine a scenario where I'm here, this guy is 0.7, and this is a deterministic case. 0.7 away from goal, this is 0.6 away from goal, this is 0.5 away, and so on, okay, 0.5, 0.5, 0.4, 0.6, 0.7. Which would be the best? What's the optimal policy in that case? I mean, what would be, if that is the values, and if you are here, and which direction would you go? Assuming that this is the cost to the goal, then you would go this way. If you're talking about reward, then you would go obviously either this way, basically this way, assuming that you can't go that way. Now, would anything change if I made this into 0.685 and this into 0.6? 402. No. How many such tweaks can I make? Huge number. And they'll still all correspond to the same winning neighbor. Okay? So this explains why, in fact, a policy function might, so a large number of value functions might give you the same policy. Okay? And if you actually look at how fast they terminate, you will notice that, for example, as you iterate over the value function, it takes, let's say, beyond 10 iterations before the value function completely converges. And what I'm computing here is what's called a loss function that you can look up in the book. Here, on the other hand, when I change policies, policies are discrete changes. And when I go from one policy function to another policy function, you notice that the loss came very close to zero very fast. So iterations in the space of policies is actually a better idea than the iterations in the space of values. Okay? So now how do I do it? I have everything that I need to tell you what policy iteration is. I'll start the same way as value iteration. Start with a random policy. What's a random policy? Just basically, for each state, pick a random action. Okay? Then what I would do is, given that policy, I would compute what would have been the optimal value function if this were to be the optimal policy. And given this value function, I will convert it back into the optimal policy. It looks like I'm doing circular reasoning, but I'm not. Okay, so I will start with a random policy, convert it into the evaluate the policy to convert into what would have been the value function if this were to be the optimal policy. And remember, to do that, I just have to solve a bunch of linear equations. That's what I told you earlier, right? If I give you a policy, computing the value function corresponding to that policy is just a bunch of linear equations. Okay. Now, in fact, in practice, if you were to write a program, okay, I mean, complexity-wise, it's clear that solving linear equations is cheaper, complexity-wise, than solving those Bellman equations. But if you are in the business of writing the program, would you rather write an iterative Bellman update program or write the Gauss-Jordan elimination program? Iterative programs are so easy to write. So in fact, in practice, what people do is, even though these are a bunch of linear equations, they still use the value iteration method to compute the value here. Okay, except during the value iteration, the update is this update. Not, there is no max anymore. And it just converges much faster. Okay? So having done that, having come to this point, you have taken a policy, converted into a value function. Now, if this were to be the optimal value function, I can ask you, what is the optimal policy corresponding to this? How do I convert that? You know, taking this as the value function for each guy, each state looks at its maximum expected utility producing action and says that's the action I'll do. And so now you have a new policy. It's not obvious at all that there will be a new policy, but the reason there will be a new policy is because multiple values correspond to single policy. So the one-to-one correspondence occurs only at the optimum. Optimum value is the optimal policy. Until then, you can make these steps. Okay? So having done this, then I get a new value function with respect to which I get a new policy. I will then compute a new value function for that and then compute a new policy until the policies don't change between two iterations. And policies not changing between iterations is extremely easy. No state has changed its best action. There's no epsilons involved anymore. And policy iteration, if you were using value or policy iteration, then policy iteration is much better. Okay, if you are writing a program for policy or value iteration is much better because it's a no-brainer. It's so much easier to write the value iteration. Okay. But policy iteration is, in fact, a much better idea in terms of speed of convergence. Then, so I looked at two ideas, one is policy and one is value iteration, to compute the optimal policy for MDPs. Now, what if I don't have the time to compute the optimal policy? What if I've told you that, look, you have to do an action. You know, I'll give you 3 minutes. In those 3 minutes, you have to do an action. You have to pick an action and do it. So suppose I am in state S init, right? And I could either do this action or this action. Those are the only actions. So remember that wherever I am, the only actions I can do are the actions that are actually applicable in that state. So it's not like I get to do any possible thing in the world. Only the things that I can do from this state is presenting me. They are the ones that are presenting my choice. The real question then is, should I do A1 or A2? I don't have to make up my mind. If I have no time whatsoever, I'll take a coin, toss. If it comes heads, I'll do A1. If not, I'll do A2. And if I have N actions, I'll take an N-sided coin and toss, and whatever it says, I'll do. But suppose I've been given like 10 minutes to think. 10 minutes is not enough to compute the optimal policy. If I computed the optimal policy, I know exactly what I'm supposed to do in S init. 10 minutes is neither enough to compute the optimal policy, nor is it enough to say you, I mean, nor is it enough to bitch and moan saying you didn't give me any time to think. I did give you 10 minutes to think. So what would you do then? Here is an idea. I will look ahead. I will just look ahead. So I will do fixed depth simulation, some, you know, limited depth simulation. So if I'm in SN, S init, I could do either A1 or A2. Now it turns out that my model tells me A1 with probability P1 takes me to S1, with probability P2 takes me to S2. And A2 with probability P3 takes me to S3, with P4 takes me to S4. Okay? Now suppose if the clock falls right here, and I say, okay, now you have only 0.01 seconds left. Wind up, wind up, wind up. Okay? Then what do I do? I'll say, okay, these states, look at these states. How good are they? I'll provide an estimate of goodness of these states. One estimate could be some H function you might have. Another dumb estimate, at least, is to take the immediate reward of these states as the state, as the estimate itself. Okay? Yeah, the immediate reward itself becomes the estimate of the goodness of the state. And then I back it up. So if this is this much, this is this much, then I expect P1 times this much plus P2 times this much here. And then I expect P3 times this much plus P4 times this much here. Now I have S init can expectedly do this much, this well here, which one would you pick? You pick maximum. You pick the maximum expected utility value. So you do max at this level and expected at this level. Okay? And if I give you more than 10 minutes, I would have spent more time extending this further deeper and doing whatever I did here, I would have done there. So whatever time I have, I'll keep expanding this tree of possibilities. And when I'm about to run out of time, I'll quickly take the estimates for the states in the bottom as either the H value, whichever H I have, or if nothing else, just take the reward function itself, immediate reward function itself. And then you back it up. And back up and do the max. That cannot be worse than tossing the coin. And the more farther down you look up, look ahead, the more likely that what you are doing is closer to the optimum action. This provides a beautiful way of doing real-time action. This is called real-time dynamic programming. And I'll show you a version later. I'm not showing you this right now. Don't worry. I'll show you a version of RTDP for A star next class. But I'll end this class today by saying the following question. I'm doing here, expect in this level I'm doing expected value computation. Suppose what A1 does is with probability P1 this, probability P2 this, right? Suppose I am a very risk-averse person. That means I assume that something bad can possibly happen, will definitely happen to me. That's the way I live. So if somebody tells me that you will either get $10,000 with 0.9 probability or get hit on your head with 0.1 probability, I assume I'm definitely going to be get hit on the head. This is risk averseness. because I really believe this is, in fact, when publisher clearinghouse sends you these forms, when I was first a graduate student and I came here and they sent me this mail and said, you would have won one of these four prizes. One is Jaguar, and one is BMW, one is like some great computer, and one is a cheaper ring. And I assume that I have equal probability of winning any of them, so there is a 3/4 probability that I have won a car already. And you know, actually, that if you've been here, and in fact, I remember telling my friends that, you know, next time I'll be driving a car, and then they laughed at me because they assume that you should be, in this case, the assumption should be that the publisher's clearinghouse is going to stick it to you. Okay, they will do, you would think that the best thing will happen to you, and they will make sure that the worst possible thing that they listed will happen to you. So in publisher's clearinghouse kind of scenario, or a scenario where this I get to do, and this gets to be picked up by my opponent. Whether A1 will do this direction or this direction, get picked up by my opponent, who wants to win just as badly, or who wants me to lose just as badly as I want to win. Then it makes no sense whatsoever to take the expected value. I should just take minimum at this level and maximum at the top level. If you do the backup, doing minimum for my opponent and maximum for me, you do min-max. Min-max is the bread and butter of game research. That's your connection from MDPs to game research. Okay? Now, it's also possible to go through life being a perpetual optimist, which is what I was hoping, that, you know, this guy sent me one of these four cars. I really like Jaguar, so probably that's what I'll get. Okay? So then I would be doing max-max computation. People will laugh at me, but I would do max-max computation to decide what my optimal action is. Your optimal action would change based on whether you're doing expected value at your opponent level, expected value at this level, or max value, or min value. There is no choice here. I think everybody wants to maximize their value if they know what the values are. Okay? So we'll come back and talk about min-max search with respect to game theory.